Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up. Thank you for joining me, or technically the Last American Vagabond, since this is an interview today, not the Daily Wrap-Up, but nonetheless, a lot of important things to get into. And this is this ongoing foreign policy adventurism that we've continued to see for a very long time. It's becoming so much more obvious and so much more just the fact that they're doing this underneath all of the coronavirus stuff is something that's really becoming to it's something that has been bothering me, especially because I haven't been covering it as much as I used to now that I'm covering so much about the coronavirus discussion. So I wanted to have Vanessa Beely on today to talk about what she's seeing, that she's in Damascus. And just as of the last so many days, there's multiple attacks that have happened. So we're going to have her on today to talk about what's going on there, as well as some intimidation tactics from BBC and mainstream efforts, and coming from MI6, as Vanessa's talking about, intimidating her to stop talking about the truth. It's incredible. But as always, Vanessa Beely is somebody that you should be paying attention to. So thank you so much for being here, Vanessa, and letting us know what's going on. How are you today?
Hi, good to be on.
to start off with that, it was something that really, it doesn't surprise me that they would be intimidating you and trying to scare you away from covering the truth and what you're doing. But just the fact, the way that it happened was something that really kind of just, it actually surprised me, the way that they displayed your personal information and so on. So we can start there if you'd like, or we can start on what's going on with Syria and come to that in a minute. But, what's going on?
No, let's start with what's going on in Syria. It's much more important than the BBC shenanigans. I mean, I'm kind of getting quite used to them by now. Now I tend to see them, well, it's a pretty good opportunity for me to raise the profile of what I'm actually reporting on. That's how I see it. And I try to take advantage of it, to be honest.
What's interesting is and just now it's coming to my mind, we were talking the last time we connected about the BBC attack on you at that time, right? When they were trying to do that whole big thing about the, what was it called again? I forget now, but it was all about the white helmets. And it seems like that fell flat on its face. At least in the larger sense. I mean, clearly they're still propagandizing, but I would argue that the way that you pushed back and the way that independent media pushed back had an effect on that. And I just, that's always a positive thing to point out, that we're definitely affecting their reach, you know, and their ability to reach people.
Oh, sorry. No worries. My cat is a complete diva. It's like every time the camera goes on, she knows it's on.
Right. I get lucky with mine. She'll just lay here next to me the entire time, not even make a sound.
No, she just loves to be in shot. I mean, you know, that's the entire point. I mean, the May Day series, which was 13 or I think 15 episodes in the end of BBC audio documentary, trying to basically, I'm really sorry about this.
No worries.
It's like, will you go away? Go and find a fly or something. trying desperately to revive the credibility of the white helmets, to whitewash the operations of the founder of the white helmets, James Lemessurier, who died in mysterious circumstances in November 2019, having been accused of fraud and embezzling funds from May Day Rescue, which was the NGO that was set up to act as a mediator between the British government and the White Helmets themselves, which of course were funded and created by the British government in the first place.
And I would add there also the person who probably knows where all the bodies are buried, kind of a phrase in regard to the whole White Helmet scenario. And, you know, the guy that knows if there's something to be known. Interesting. That would happen with the helmets, you know?
Yeah. I mean, basically the May Day series was an absolute operation in damage limitation. It lied through a mission on numerous subjects, particularly on OPCW, the revelations that OPCW had doctored the reports and suppressed evidence from actual members of the investigative teams in order to retrospectively justify the US, UK, French unlawful aggression against Syria in 2018. Are you still there?
Yes, sorry. I was giving you the screen since you were...
Oh, sorry. I was no like...
Well, since you paused right there, what I was just really kind of drilling into the other day, I think actually yesterday at the end of the show, was how many times we've seen not just the counter narrative from the independent media, but you know, Carla Delapontaine from the UN from one of these earlier events where she has stated on record that it was at the rebels that the evidence pointed to, or the fact that Mattis, in regard to, I believe it was, I mean, it's more than once, in fact, from Mattis, where he admitted that the evidence they have for Assad gassing people simply wasn't there, you know, and it's just, we have all this stuff, or the fact that the Duma event has been completely just dismantled. And it's just, they just get up and continue to state, we have all these times that Assad has used these weapons. And it's just like, it's, you know, where's the disconnect here? Like, I get that we see this, and I do argue that most people probably recognize it, but how is it that the entirety of the UN, why doesn't the UN stand up collectively and be like, we all know that's not true? You know, it's like, it perpetuates this system of allowing these criminal governments to just completely state their lies with no pushback, it seems. It's interesting.
I mean, the UN itself is an entirely compromised organization.
I agree.
Which is basically, you know, another outreach agent for the US, UK.
What are your thoughts?
I'm
sorry, there's a little bit of a delay.
No, go for it.
What are your thoughts on somebody like Evo Morales, let's say? Obviously, he was clearly pushed out of that scenario, but I made a big deal about when he stood up and spoke during one of Trump's UN leading meetings, where he made this huge speech. And I even pointed out at the time, I said, the future regime change for Bolivia, I called it right on, right? Because he stood up and said everything we're talking about in front of everybody in the UN. So I always think about that yes, I agree, the UN as an institution is clearly a toothless tiger. It's been co-opted, but there are still entities, I would argue, maybe trying to do what they think is right, or at least doing what they think is beneficial to them and in alliance with what's right sometimes, yeah. You know?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I mean, there are countries, for example, that have behind the scenes supported Syria, for example. Mm-hmm. I know right. That for a fact. They may abstain in certain votes, but effectively they know what's going on. But, I mean, I remember, I think it was around 2 or 3 years ago, I actually had a meeting at one of the UN offices because it was an off the record meeting, but it was someone relatively high up in connection with the Syria case. And I had a meeting with them about the White Helmets at that time after the massacre in Rashidin and Aleppo. So that would have been April 2017, when it was believed that the White Helmets and the armed groups had actually taken children, dead, dying, injured children, away from the scene of the bombing. As far as I know, at least 50 of those children that were taken are still missing, suspected used for organ trafficking.
What are your thoughts on the possibility that it's also for things such as, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden, it's an odd name, you'll remember, I'm sure, the BBC producer that admitted that they had arranged the dead bodies and so on. Like, that's a thing that pops into my mind, the idea that those could be used for other...
Oh, Ram Talati.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there is potential for that. I did also at the same kind of time interview parents in Aleppo in particular, whose children had been abducted, and they were receiving information from inside Idlib that the children were kept together, that the White Helmets were involved in that, that the kids were being moved around whenever they thought that they might stage another chemical weapon event. So, yeah, you know, there is a strong possibility of that. But to come back to the fact that I was speaking to an official in the UN, and they basically said to me, they were actually very open with me. They said the problem is that the UN itself is never going to investigate the White Helmets or to admit that the White Helmets are committing crimes against the Syrian people because they are too politicized. Huh. Right.
Just state that outright. I mean, that's incredible, right? I mean,
and
go ahead.
This cat is driving me wild. I don't know why, like, she slept for the last 2 hours. And if I'm not on camera, she will never come by me.
Right, right. It's always about you being invested in something else, you know.
But, oh, God, that's completely distracted me now.
Oh, no, it's the...
No, and the other point that I wanted to make, coming back to the BBC, was... also a couple of years ago, I kind of bumped into Lise Doucet of the BBC here in Damascus. And I remember having sort of a relatively civilized conversation with her. But one of my questions to her was, why doesn't the BBC investigate or cover the accusations against the White Helmets? Now, her response to me as a journalist working or a Middle East correspondent working for the BBC was, well, it's too controversial and it's too polarizing. So,
for a news organization.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of momentarily speechless at that point. But that's a political answer. That's not a media answer.
Exactly.
Right? You know, and so that those two statements, if you like, kind of to me correlated. You know, the BBC, which is effectively state media, which has been responsible for maintaining the narrative that has maintained the regime change war against Syria and criminalized the Syrian government and its allies, etc., and the Syrian Arab Army, is saying that it's too controversial and too polarizing to investigate a UK Foreign Office asset working inside Syria to produce the propaganda that the BBC then uses to criminalize the Syrian government, right?
Yeah.
And a UN official who was, if you like, sympathetic to what I was saying is also telling me it's too political. You know, this subject is never going to be properly investigated or properly looked at. You know, in the same way, if you remember, you mentioned Carla Del Ponte, when she investigated the organ trafficking, the cross-border organ trafficking in Pristina, Kosovo in 1999, conducted by the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, you know, yet another kind of euphemism for a terrorist organization, power multiplied by Albanian warlords that were carrying out cross-border organ trafficking operations. Of course, the UN also tried to stop or impede her investigation. She had a huge amount of obstacles put in her way to actually look into that entire, you know, heinous crime that was being carried out against Serbs, predominantly, of course, which was another reason why it was sort of pushed under the carpet.
Under what context, how, or under what justification this is what really frustrates me, is that this kind of stuff can be on the surface where nobody can justify why we wouldn't want to investigate what happened. So how can they justify saying, no, you can't investigate that obvious thing? But if it was something that they even, you know, if the Observatory for Human Rights claimed that something happened in Syria, it would be all over the news. They investigate for a week.
No.
So, you know, it's just such an obvious contrast there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, that is my argument all the time. These accusations are being levied against the White Helmets by Syrian civilians.
Right.
You know, I'm not making these accusations up. This is coming from testimonies, multiple testimonies from Syrian civilians inside Syria that lived under the occupation in various areas of the armed groups. And, of course, the White Helmets that were always working in collaboration with those same armed groups. And so, for me, you know, if just one person raises the question of organ trafficking, not multiple people, then all of these humanitarian organizations, which of course have been instrumental in maintaining the war against Syria, should be at least investigating it. But instead, and it was quite interesting because the May Day series, Chloe Hajimatyu actually brings in a rather controversial figure, Abd al-Qadir Habak, who was actually part of the UK Foreign Office training program for journalists and activists inside Syria through both ARC and BASMA. Now, ARC, of course, was the company that James Mazurier was working for when he established the White Helmets. Huh. So that's number one. So this was an immediate conflict of interest, which was not declared by the BBC. Effectively, yeah, they were bringing in a researcher and a cameraman who had been trained and implanted in various areas of Syria to produce the media that served UK Foreign Office policy, and by that I mean the US coalition foreign policy, inside Syria. But not only that, he had been filming with the actual child beheader of Abdullah Issa in August 2016 in Aleppo. Now, Channel 4 had pushed out that that footage that he had produced, calling it up close with the rebels, until people pointed out, well, these aren't really rebels. These are actual the people that beheaded and tortured a 12-year-old child. The film was taken down, but of course everyone by then had downloaded it. And so basically they brought this guy on to provide a narrative to cover up the fact that the White Helmets were being accused of organ trafficking. And his excuse was to basically say, yeah, but these bodies were taken away to Turkey for autopsy, and that's why they came back with the organs missing. Now, an actual, let's say, somebody that I work with occasionally, but who has a medical background and who up until that point had been slightly skeptical about the, because he, I think they just found it all a bit too sort of too much, you know,
it's hard to accept for the average person.
Yeah, the whole organ trafficking concept. Yeah. But they actually said to me, you know, up until that point, I had been reticent about looking at this subject, but the fact that the BBC brought somebody to cover it up and to provide a kind of alibi for it, and it was such a shoddy alibi, he said, I'm totally on board. I think now they were doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the May Day series was a complete, it was a complete train wreck.
Right. I mean, what I was saying, I feel like that has large part in do, or I mean, I would hope to do with the pushback that happened before it even came out. You know, we were successfully laying the narrative already, going like, look, prepare yourself for this propaganda monster that's going to come out, you know, and it just kind of speaks to our ability to actually make a difference in these things, which before I argue, at least it seemed much more impossible. You know, it's a good thing. But on the note of on the discussion of the trafficking and everything else, then I want to bring this back to what just happened in Syria is history. And I ask people to look into The Last American Vagabond specifically, as well as a lot of their websites, to look at the research over the years of the peacekeepers, the WHO or Oxfam or Red Cross, or the history of sexual allegations of rape and molestation and organ trafficking and stuff like proven allegations. People get arrested and it just continues forward. This is covered up on a regular basis. And I come back to this point after we talk about Syria, but because this point seems more relevant to this moment, this is an interesting point in regard to somebody discussing the MI6 angle here. Thomas is pointing out sobering briefing in the UN General Assembly today on findings in regard to the embassies and the, what was it? What is the UN? It's the Syrian embassy UN. Let me look at it real quick. I just forgot what it stands for.
Which bit is it?
Syria Commission. That's they're saying. The findings of the Commission on Civil Society and Awful Human Rights Violations and Abuses. Now you dig into this story, and it's now I'm not even trying to disparage this. Let's just take it face value. Let's just pretend that it is real and we can trust that. It's one person's story about one thing that happened, and that's taking it face value that one, that she's telling the truth, and then realizing the reality that there is 100,000 examples of families being bombed and murdered in Yemen that we know are an absolute fact, or the fact that Gaza is open air. I mean, all these examples, and yet we have this huge UN General Assembly to discuss one person's claims about what's going on in Syria. I mean, it's just staggering, the disconnect, the out of touch. I think it's by choice, obviously, but we'll come back to the other follow-up point in regard to what he says and how that relates to you. But I just find that to be absolutely staggering that they continue to drive this in. Like, it reminds me of what's her name? The young girl that they used and trot her out.
Oh, Bana. I love it. Yeah.
Man. And you know, I don't want to make it out to be that I'm not despair. For all I know, what happened to that girl is real. And, you know, there's a story there, but it's not the point. The point is about how we ignore massive war crimes and genocide happening while we point to one example and make that out to be all that we should care about.
You know, this is the power of propaganda in the media. I mean, everyone probably remembers the story of Omran. Right, the little boy CNN anchor breaking down in tears. You
know? And of course, he was the one in the ambulance, for those that remember, with the blood, and the father spoke up and said, they just basically staged that.
Yeah, I mean, they exploited the situation, and the shelling was from the armed groups. I mean, you know, that Eva Bartlett in particular has kind of completely debunked that entire story, as his actual family debunked it.
Right.
You know?
Interviews. You know?
Yeah.
And interviews are on RT, so it's fake news, you know?
Yeah. You know. And then, of course, you know, who actually remembers Aylan Kurdi, the little boy that washed up on the beach, you know?
Right.
And that launched, of course, then the whole kind of refugee crisis narrative. And that, for a long time, became one of the kind of pivotal narratives to demonize Assad and to turn against the Syrian government, etc.
Right, despite the fact that that was being caused by the aggressions of the West, which doesn't matter.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But this brings us perfectly into what's going on now, you know, and
yeah.
This is what really does continue to bother me almost, you know, the fact that this is happening now under, like, their narrative is that this is the worst pandemic in a century. So that then you're okay bombing civilians during the worst pandemic. And I mean, there's no connect there. And I get why governments are all lying about it, but where's all the average people? Like, we can see what's happening. Biden will bomb Syria despite arguing all the things he's going to do different. So just the same, he's Trump with a different narrative. And now we have Israel openly doing so and even threatening Biden, saying, if you go back in the JCPOA, we're going to attack Iran. That was straight from Netanyahu's mouth. And so it just shows you the lack of respect, if that even exists between them, to say, like, we don't care about your agreements. We're going to do what we want. And it just shows you who really has the power in that dynamic. So let's start off, if you will, to comment on Biden's actions in Syria. And then let's go into what just happened from Israel. And we'll bring that to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting is that since Biden's inauguration, of course, we've seen, first of all, the reemergence of ISIS, which,
right,
of course, then
like
is... Yeah, you know, I mean, just almost immediately, mm-hmm. right? And there were, since New Year, there were a series of attacks on Syrian Arab army positions, on oil depots, on gas pipelines, etc., by ISIS, of course, that are emanating from the U.S. occupation base Al-Tanf in the southeast on the border with Jordan, and from the northeast coming in from Iraq. And actually, I just, because when you mentioned COVID, what I want to point out is not only the bombing of Syria and Iraq, but also the movement of U.S. troops. I mean, U.S. troops have been pouring into the northeast. They've been establishing new military bases in some of the richest oil resource areas. They're building a new base in Iraq, closer to Syria with an air base. They're replenishing their forces in Al-Tanf. They're running military exercises with the armed groups that are in the 55-kilometer exclusion zone around Al-Tanf and in the Al-Rukban refugee camp. And that exclusion zone, by the way, is Syrian territory that Syrian army and any of their allies are not allowed to enter. And in fact, the armed groups that are being trained and equipped by the U.S. in that exclusion zone are regularly attacking Syrian Arab army and even Russian positions. So, you know, and I just want to read something from a report that just came in just before I came on. 25 ISIS terrorists entered from the Iraqi territories on February 28th to Al-Sal town in the southern countryside of Hasakah. Now, Hasakah is the area close to where the U.S. has established a new camp in the kind of triangle, the furthermost northeast triangle between Turkey and Syria and Iraq. So the terrorists were gathered in another area before conveying them by U.S. armored cars to the illegal U.S. camp Al-Bulgar base to the east of al-Shabdadi city in the southern countryside of Hasakah. So it's all in that area that the U.S. is reinforcing with American hardware, American artillery, American tanks, American troops. So the military footprint of the U.S. during the pandemic is actually increasing inside Syria. So the terrorists were conveyed by two U.S. helicopters, and then taken to the countryside of Deir ez-Zor.
Which is very common. We've talked about that many times. Yeah. And shuttling back and forth. I was trying to grab I just grabbed it just real quick. I wanted to show what you were reading since you had shared that earlier. It's really common that we see this happen over and over where they will shuttle them from Afghanistan to Iraq to back and forth. Here's what you were reading. Just so you keep going.
Yeah, exactly. And that literally, that came in today and it's being confirmed by sources on the ground there. And as you rightly say, I mean, the US has been ferrying terrorists backwards and forwards to Al-Tanf, where, as I said, they're being trained and equipped, and also into Iraq, where they've been doing that for some time, right? In order to retrain them to produce a sort of super ISIS and then bring it back in. And those are the groups that have been carrying out the attacks on Syria and Arab army positions on the gas lines. There was an attack on a gas line a few days ago, and today we're back to kind of 10-kilometer queues for fuel here in Damascus. So, you know, all the time, this is it's twofold. It's to recreate the reason for the U.S. coalition to be in Syria, one, and two, to further deprive Syrians of their resources. You know, the SDF, while this is happening, they're selling off all the agricultural food stuff now. So they're depriving now the farmers of the food for their animals. Previously, of course, they were burning crops and then selling wheat and barley into Iraq.
And hear what she's saying there. She's not saying deprive the government. They're depriving the people of Syria of in the middle of, I mean, not only in the biggest pandemic in a century, just remember that that's what they keep telling us. And this is all underneath that. But the fact that they're in the middle of winter and the people are starving and they don't have heat, they don't have food. It's just so obviously counter to what they claim they're trying to accomplish all the time. But what kills me about this is not only the footprint you're talking about, that's just always in that same point, right? So, I mean, this goes back all the way to 1918 and the Kansas flu, which if we look up, that's actually where this began, not Spanish flu. That's, you can look it up on Wikipedia. But the idea that the way that spread, as we know now, was by General Pershing and the U.S. military, and how they continued to spread the military knowing this was happening and just not caring. And this is on record. So think about how funny it is that in the middle of what they tell us is the biggest pandemic, they're marching their military around the world. And in most pictures, you find they're not doing all the things they tell us we need to be doing, masking and distancing and whatever else. I'm not arguing we should be. It just shows you how hypocritical they are. And now bringing it back to the idea that we're dealing with ISIS in the sense, I believe it's my opinion, absolutely the first part more than anything, that they use this to justify why they're there. But also, what are your thoughts on the concept of the Katyusha rockets that keep getting used and how there is countless examples of ISIS having these, using these in Syria? You know, do you think that that's what's happening, or what are your thoughts on that whole dynamic with the rockets that wouldn't be used by the PMU, which is just insulting to our intelligence, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very possible, of course, that this is a false flag operation to justify the aggression from Biden in particular. You know, this insane narrative that Biden had knocked out Iranian positions. I mean, this is exactly the same narrative that we hear all the time from Israel when it's illegally bombing Syria, as it did literally only on Sunday night, just after I'd finished with Slow News Day. Literally, they bombed, and it was pretty early because normally they bomb in the early hours of the morning. This was around 10 o'clock at night. And so Biden is using exactly the same narrative. Basically, he's saying this is a preemptive self-defense strike to protect our assets, which are rapidly becoming vulnerable liabilities in Iraq, of course. And that justified his hitting a border point with Iraq and Syria, Bukamal. I think Kavok Al-Masian made a very important point. He said, this is a message from Biden. It's attacking the main border crossing between, let's say, friendly Iraq and Syria. It's the border crossing which is defended very much by the PMU, which, of course, Biden and Israel will describe as Iranian proxies. They are not. You know, this is an organization. It's a military organization that was established to challenge ISIS and actually defended the country against ISIS when America did nothing. Exactly. You know, when ISIS was on the point of invading Baghdad, it was the PMU that drove them back, not the Lebanese army, not the Iraqi army, and not the Americans.
This is with the obvious influence and aid of Soleimani, General Soleimani at the time, right? When this was the whole, and this is what I always get frustrated about, is the argument that he, you know, murdered America. This is when he was defending a sovereign country from an illegal invasion. I always point that out. So if a foreign country invaded Florida and all of a sudden we were fighting them back, does that make us terrorists for defending their, you know, that's what they're trying to make this out to be, you know?
Yeah, but also, I mean, the PMU is a very pluralist organization. It comprises not only of, as they like to describe them, Iranian proxies. No, I mean, you know, it contains Yazidis, Christians, Sunnis, even in the leadership. I mean, I actually was very privileged to meet with Mohandas, the leader of the PMU, as part of a media delegation a few years ago. You know, this was a very intelligent, he was an engineer, I think.
For those who might not know, this is the gentleman that was assassinated alongside Soleimani.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and this guy in Iraq was a hero. I mean, because not only, I mean, they do have certain similarities to Hezbollah in the sense that, yes, they were fighting ISIS, but they were also responsible for the rebuilding of Iraq. So everything that ISIS had destroyed, the PMU, the engineering units, were immediately going and repairing bridges, repairing roads, etc., and rebuilding the country after, you know, what is effectively another U.S. proxy, another terrorist proxy of the U.S., ISIS, had destroyed that country.
And in fact, it's important to remember that the U.S., and up until today, as far as I understand it, has actively tried to block, stop, and delay any kind of rebuilding, right? Under the guise, we need this or that. Yeah. And it just, you know, so it just shows you how much they care about the average people, you know?
No, they don't. I mean, you know, under the under the Caesar law, I mean, I had a meeting with one of the deputy ministers of health here 2 days ago. And I mean, it's extraordinary the number of hospitals and health centers that were destroyed by the war and by the terrorist groups that deliberately took over, for example, in East Aleppo, they took over the children's hospital and the eye hospital. They turned it into a torture center, into a prison, into a Sharia court. And they used it to further punish, collectively punish, the Syrian people that would not comply with their extremist ideology. And so, you know, when the media talk about the destruction of hospitals, sanctions are destroying the entire health sector in this country deliberately to prevent the Syrian people receiving the medical care that they need, including for cancer, including for all manner of chronic illnesses. And of course, you can also mirror that in Yemen.
Right.
You know, the siege and blockade in Yemen is causing greater death than the military aggression by the Saudi coalition. And that, again, is deliberate. And that, again, is being facilitated by the UN. Yep. Just as it was in Iraq, just as it was in Libya, and just as it is in Venezuela, in Syria, etc. Sanctions are never to target a government. They are always to target the people.
And if you look far enough back, they'll say that themselves, right? It's sort of like how the Department of War becomes the Department of Defense, and we act like that never happened. You know, it's clear that they've spoken on the record before, you know, the Kissingers of the world, you know, kind of talk about it in their circles in about how they use people and about how the sanctions are about making them, what's the term they use? Scream was a term that was used in regard to the South America, right? Or Pompeo saying, if you want your people to eat, do what we're saying. And these are all things that they state and then try to reel backward and go, but no, this is what it actually meant. You know, they know this. The sanctions are about bringing people to desperation so that they revolt on their government. And this is the interesting part, as I always point out, is it's not that they don't know that's happening. We're going to drive them to such a desperate state that they don't really care what happens next, as long as the terrible things stop. Right. That's seemingly it's worked in the past. That's why I sort of point out that right now we are under U.S. sanctions as Americans. That's what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, this is the whole point, you know. The whole COVID-19, I don't know what you want to call it, hoax, construct, whatever,
illusion,
is effectively the hybrid strategy now being turned on domestic populations.
Right, this right.
Cat is...
I know, I see.
But, you know, but you're right.
It's such a perfect, you know, it's everything they're using everywhere else in a domestic health setting. You know, it's the biosecurity state that they're building around us right now, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's what I keep saying. People keep saying to me, why are we talking about Syria when all this stuff is happening? Because, yeah,
it's interconnected.
You know, Syria is a mirror of what is happening to you. And Syria, if you actually consider what's happening here, it's an example of how to survive and how to resist.
Yes.
You know, and equally, this entire power grab is all about creating isolationism, making us all start to withdraw inwards and to stop looking outwards and to stop considering the other issues that are going on under the umbrella of COVID, because everyone is focused on COVID and on lockdown and on you know, their own depression, their own all the issues that are being created by the disproportionate measures taken against a virus.
Right.
And in fact, what is going on under that is an increase in the aggression against countries like Yemen, like Syria, like Iraq.
Cover of the whole COVID hysteria.
Yeah, because nobody's paying attention, and they know that.
Exactly. Biden comes out of the gate acting like we're going to do everything different. And then just, you know, the same thing Trump did, by the way, but, you know, just immediately jumps into it. You know, I mean, the thing, what I think about it is the Great Reset idea, whatever, you know, whatever they're trying to build with all of this and drive, which is like insultingly obvious. Build Back Better is literally Biden's running campaign. It's like, and he's all over. It's a Great Reset. It's like, really, how are we going to miss that? But they're trying to drive this in, and obviously this is a worldwide agenda. I mean, it's about creating, whether it's a global currency or one world government or whatever, these things that we used to laugh at as, not we, but people, like, crazy conspiracy theory, and now they're literally going, here's what we want to build. And it's like, it's exactly what we've been saying. But I think they need all these people. Right. So, for instance, the COVID agenda and what's happening within the U.S., for instance, is a major part of this, especially for us as Americans looking outward. But it wouldn't work, let's say, if they could get everything but Syria. I mean, look at how, like, Sweden, for instance, and I don't even know if that's genuine, but is kind of this sore thumb in their whole narrative where Sweden's just not doing what they're supposed to. And it's proving that they're not. We don't need to, right? It's the same difference. So if Syria, for instance, isn't toppled, it isn't taken control of, it will stand out as something that, well, look, we don't need to do what they're making us do. So that's kind of what, it's all interconnected. There's a clear, massive agenda that's happening right now. And it's, you know, that's, I tend to think what's going to happen is at some point this, what Whitney and I've discussed in the past, the whole, you know, Klaus keeps pushing this, Klaus Schwab, this cyber pandemic idea. Is they're going to try to roll this back in with foreign policy, where Iran, let's say, carries out a cyber attack that creates some kind of a pandemic of a sorts. Like, what if they attack vaccine infrastructure or so on? You'll see this come together in a way where they pull in foreign policy, you know? Don't worry about it. I see.
Why. No, it's just really annoying having her right behind my head.
Right, right. But
yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think another important development that we've noticed, and I'm kind of looking into it now, is now this ramping up of the legal cases against President Assad. You know, we're seeing revivalism of the ICC case, which I'd already reported on a couple of years ago. We're seeing the change of the prosecutor at the ICC from Bensouda, who was criticized for not having brought enough cases to the ICC, to a QC, a British QC, Karim Khan, who has a reputation for bringing cases in, and who has connections to the lawyers that are running the legal operations against President Assad, with some degree of backing from the UK Foreign Office. We're seeing the recent trials in Germany in Koblenz of the alleged former security officers accused of torture. We're seeing the report that's just come out that was published by Thomas Phipps that he used to further attack me on Twitter. So we're seeing what I'm calling the Milosevic operation, right? Mm-hmm. In my view. They haven't won militarily. They haven't won politically or diplomatically. They haven't won in the media. They've been fully exposed. And non-released the UK Foreign Office documents exposing the extent to which the UK Foreign Office was involved in the black op against Syria. And so now, rather than sort of retreating and going, well, okay, let's make a deal, mm-hmm. right? No, this is the nature of the imperialist nations. They can't accept they've lost. If you look at now what's happening in Yemen and the recent exposure of British MI6 and CIA operations in the Al-Qaeda held territories to the east of Yemen in Al-Mara province, where they were basically trying to flip members of Ansarullah over to British intelligence to
Sorry. There's always a delay between us with this, but I just want to make sure that people know that the Houthis, for those that don't know the other name that were the Ansarullah. Go ahead, please continue.
Yeah, I mean the Houthis is a little bit of a it's a bit of a media concept to try and portray them as a small group of guerrillas, basically, rather than an actual resistance movement.
What I found interesting was that, and the reason I say that is not to argue that's what we should call them, but just so people know what we're talking about.
I understand. What I find
interesting, though, is that the way I see them trying to play that is you have the Saudis, which is named after a family name. So it's a monarchy. It's an authoritarian, right? So, but this is an elected government, but they try to make it out to be the family name. So I feel like that's kind of how they're trying to play that. Which is funny, but that's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, the current government in Yemen, which was elected constitutionally under Yemen constitution, is made up, I think, of around 38 political parties. So this is a power share. This is effectively a coalition government. And Ansarullah is representative of the resistance against neocolonialism, and particularly against Saudi occupation and resource plundering, etc., that has been going on for decades, and the corruption, etc., etc., etc. But actual Yemenis who were co-opted into British intelligence and American intelligence were captured and questioned. And it turns out that MI6 and CIA have been running these operations in the eastern province of Yemen, which is effectively the main area of Al-Qaeda, to find out the coordinates of Ansarullah positions, of their drone bases, of their air defense bases, and to basically destroy them, but also to pinpoint leaders of Ansarullah, leaders of the military, in order to assassinate them. So, I don't remember a time, actually, when the British Foreign Office and intelligence agencies were being exposed on such a high level. Mm-hmm. I mean, Anon recently released documents both on showing the operations against Russia and the operations to infiltrate Lebanese security, army, intelligence, government in order to secure influence to counter what they perceive as the power of Hezbollah inside Lebanon, and also to reinstate their influence in Tripoli. Now, Tripoli is probably going to become the most influential port in Lebanon after, of course, the explosion in Beirut that decimated Beirut.
So Tripoli will be ignored by the world.
Yeah. And Tripoli, if we go back to the beginning of the war against Syria, was also pivotal to the US project of the Qatari pipeline that would pass through Homs, then to Tripoli, and then into Europe, right? So what we're seeing now under Biden, in my view, is a reemergence of the old plan.
Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like. And like yeah. we said before, on a dime too, all of a sudden, even you know what I even noticed is even like Kim Jong-un suddenly said, the West is the biggest threat to us. Out of nowhere, right when after Biden got elected. And that's just another part of this that seemed absolutely silent during Trump's administration. And it's just, you know, it just seems like they're pulling out all the stops for, like you said, what they were doing before.
And I mean, all of a sudden you've got Israel is integrated into CENTCOM.
Which is very alarming. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, this is okay. We can argue that probably Israel was always involved in CENTCOM. Exactly. But this is, you know, a legitimization of that more clandestine collaboration in CENTCOM. This is now, it's now up there, but even more important is the fact that now the collaboration between Israel and what they term the pragmatic Sunni Islam states, right? So hence the normalization of relations between Israel and UAE, for example, the growing normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And so now what you see is the concretization of that new front, that Sunni Islam, Zionist, US, Saudi Arabia, Wahhabi frontline against Iran. I mean, they even talk about anti-Iran operations. They're talking, of course, of multi-spectrum war. So they're talking about cyber attacks. They're talking about all manner of ways of targeting Iran preemptively. Of course, Israel's aggression is almost always based in preemptive aggression, which they then justify as calling it self-defense. Well, we're defending ourselves against the potential of an Iranian attack. And Biden is actually using that same language, of course, in his attack on Bukam Al in Syria.
Right. The UK, the United States, and Israel, as far as I understand it, are the ones that not openly necessarily, but embrace the Bethlehem Doctrine, which is what preemptive self-defense comes from. But they won't let you see it. It's top, you know, you can't look into how they dissect it. You know, it came out under the whole thing with Soleimani, right? Where they had to basically admit, well, all we needed was, you know, to know that this guy might in someday in the future do something. And so then we can just murder people. And they basically admitted that. It was a really embarrassing moment for them, you know? And and to point out here in Yemen, for instance, I know you're probably going to lose power in a few minutes here. Is that look at how insulting it is that we know this. So the MI6, the CIA are involved in Yemen. They're there making it worse. We know you and I actually previously discussed the UAE torture prisons where the CIA was photographed right there watching it happen. And yet we all act like we don't know what's going on in the world's worst humanitarian crisis. You know, just shows you this just disgusting lack of concern for human rights, human safety, liberty, freedom, whatever you else want to call it, as they pretend that's what they're doing. And it's like that all across the world. You know, go ahead.
No, I mean, and I think, you know, it's also important to register the fact that the US, for example, is moving Patriot missiles onto, or air defense, sorry, onto Socotra, which is an island, of course, belonging to Yemen, off the coast of Yemen. Mm-hmm. The UK is effectively moving back into Aden, where, of course, that was basically under British colonial rule previously. So, you know, yes, this is neocolonialism on steroids. But if we come back to Syria also in the northeast, not only is the US increasing its military footprint under the cover of the pandemic, the UK now is also funding a project in the northeast to expand the ISIS camp. So all this movement, all this shifting around of ISIS, it will become official that there is an ISIS camp. Now, within that ISIS camp, of course, there are going to be British ISIS operatives, they're going to be American ISIS operatives, French, German, all nationalities in these protected camps.
Is this the moment where we see them actually and continue to make the argument that we should somehow normalize relations with this group? Because that's been made before. And they floated the idea, sort of how we now work with, you know, we're making deals with the Taliban, despite them literally being one of the names used to justify what they did after 9/11, you know, and nothing's changed. It's sort of like their normalization with the Sudan. They say, well, you're terrorists, but as long as you normalize with Israel, we don't care. You know, just we'll make it normal. You know, the Taliban is what they were when they claimed they were trying to annihilate them for our safety, right? I mean, give or take, but they are. Go ahead. You have a comment there?
Well, no, I mean, I think if we go back to the CENTCOM story, of course, and the fact that Israel is now aligning itself with pragmatic Sunni Islamic states, mm-hmm. right? And in that, it's including Saudi Arabia, probably the greatest producer of terror globally. Yeah. Right. So that's what I'm trying to say is now we're seeing a normalization of Israel working with groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the other kind of extremist armed groups that it has been arming and providing hospital treatment for. But this is complete normalization of that relationship. All right.
Do you think it will come to a point where they actually make an argument? Your opinion where it may go. But do you think that may come to pass where they actually try to make an argument that here's why we should normalize relations with this group? Or do you think it'll be a sort of a Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, change their name kind of a route? Maybe not happening at all. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I do actually remember, and I can't remember his name right now, but there was an Israeli official who actually said they would prefer to have ISIS in power to President Assad.
Right. And I've seen more than one example where that's sort of like not so subtly been floated, and even ones that like kind of pull it back and change their title kind of a thing, you know? And so I've just been waiting for that because obviously we can see, I mean, Ben Swan did a documentary like in 2013 where it just laid out the fact that it's not a secret that the U.S. government has obvious ties to the creation, the arming, the funding, and the protecting of ISIS. And we just still to this day act like that's so crazy ridiculous, you know? But it just.
But Joe Biden has actually admitted that in 2014.
Right, exactly. Right? I played the clip on
and John Kerry admitted it in 2016 in a closed session at the UN. Right. Right? Well,
it's easy to make clear that Al-Qaeda is, at least partly is what became ISIS to a degree.
Yeah, you
know?
Exactly.
And so we know that they're behind what became Al-Qaeda. So it's not a secret to recognize that it leads to that train. But I think it's obvious there's much more going on there. But for the interest of time, because I know you're going to lose electricity in a very short period of time, I wanted to make sure we talked about what's on the screen right now, because this is crazy to me. It's not that hard to expect that they would do something like this, but that it's so blatant and so intentionally intimidating. So this you're looking at a tweet for those on the podcast. I'll just read it really quickly. It's, and this is Vanessa posting this, but it's in regard to what the BBC and MI6 essentially did to try to intimidate her. It says, it appears that the BBC MI6, and she said, I make no differentiation between the two, and I agree with that, believe they would intimidate her, by publishing image of the car she drives in Syria. Below is the email she sent to Emma Rapone and Chloe, which was the one we were just mentioning for the BBC. You can judge it for yourselves. Here's the target harassment. So if you want to comment on this, so they took a picture, they shared your car for people to see. I mean, is that, I almost take that like a way to say, like, if they're arguing that you're in a position where you're in a place that's dangerous to broadcast what car you drive, is that not an obvious way to, you know, put you in danger, at least how the narrative goes? I mean, what do you think?
Well, their argumentation is that this photo was on Facebook. My argument is on Facebook, it didn't have the context that was produced by a BBC journalist, and the article wasn't on the front page of a BBC website.
Exactly.
Clearly targeting me by contextualizing it in
you
the
could
way
argue
she
it's a form
has.
Of doxing. It's a form of doxing, in my opinion.
Yeah. It is. And it's definitely targeted harassment. Mm-hmm. They didn't speak to me before they published the photo. So they didn't get any information on the photo. They made the assumption that it is my vehicle. Now, I drive the vehicle, but it's impossible for a foreign national to buy or own a car here. So it actually belongs to a Syrian civilian who's, and when they first published it showing the number plate.
Right.
So it's very easy for anyone here to find out who owns the car. Right. Now, Syria, there are, you know, I've just demonstrated there are still terrorist cells
Oh, no. I think we just lost her. I knew that was going to happen, guys. I tried to get it in before we got to the end here. So this is just for those, I should have said this in the beginning of the show today. There was a little bit of a miscommunication. It was very clearly my fault in regard to the time we were supposed to begin today. So Vanessa and I are going to reconnect in the coming days, possibly tomorrow. Who knows, you know, in the coming days to talk more about this, because we were technically supposed to start at 2 p.m. Central Time today, and we started a little earlier, and we were just going to kind of go like we saw, you just saw, until she lost her connection. But to finish off here, just to finish what she's showing here, to go back to this, this is incredible to me. They're basically, I'm not suggesting that by showing her what car she drives there, that is putting her in danger, like as if, you know, as the same as showing your car somewhere else. But the argument would be that they're doing this with the intention of trying to intimidate her. And again, operating from within their narrative, the same way we do with everyone else, they're claiming that this is, you know, the hostile territory and, you know, whatever else, the dangerous place in Syria. And by showing that car, that's suggesting that point, like, this is, they are actively doing this with the intention to make her feel like she's at threat, or that they're pointing to her, or they're intimidating her. That's what this is about. Now, going forward, I find it really telling as well, as she points out, of course, if the BBC wishes to condemn her for driving a car with a popular image of Assad in the back window, which there is an image of Assad, which is a very common thing for these cars, as even Eva Bartlett has spoken to in Syria. And as she said, it's another person's car in Syria. So there's your explanation. Regardless, it wouldn't matter if it was, but it says, of course, the BBC will, you know, if the BBC wishes to condemn Vanessa for driving a car with a popular image of Assad, one hopes the BBC will equally condemn the white helmets for displaying Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other extremist malicious signs and signals. But of course not. Of course they won't do that. Why would they do that? Because that would make them actually objective, balanced, showing all sides. No, they don't want to do that. As she points out, there's also the issue of the BBC producers driving around in vehicles with ISIS insignia on display. Does Chloe, and remember, this is Chloe that we've already spoken about, that her locked account where you can't see, I'm probably blocked for all I know because I called her out. Yep. Oh no, their tweets are protected. Because that's what good journalists do today. They hide their information from people. You got to love them. They're propaganda. I mean, their goal is to manipulate your perception, not inform you. That's why Chloe blocks her tweets. But it says, as you can see, look, this is YouTube. Oh, from YouTube. This is from the Saving Syria Children from the BBC. That's an ISIS symbol in the back of their truck they are driving, right? Here's another, and this is the absurd, look, this was that fake manipulated joke of a thing where this guy walks around like he's all burnt and broken while everyone's standing around and perfectly fine. But no, lo and behold, there's an ISIS symbol in the back of the truck. BBC's team was working and embedded with ISIS, but nobody came, but that's totally fine. But she has the picture of the president of a sovereign country in the back of a car that's not even hers, because it's a Syrian's car that would likely have that. And that's a big deal. It's just really pathetic the way that these people operate. And back to this point, so Thomas Phipps, as she's pointing out, MI6, is simply saying, here we have this huge United Nations General Assembly Council about this one person's discussion. Now, again, I'm not trying to disparage. I mean, let's take it face value. Let's assume that what she's saying in every sense is true. We don't know for all, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of other things that could have happened here in regard to just simply saying that this is the fault of the government here. I mean, there's things that happen in this country all the time that you can't just lay at the feet of the president of the United States, but it doesn't matter in the sense of what we're trying to discuss today. Because my point is the fact that they're focusing on one person's story in regard to a government that, I argue, all governments are capable of horrible things like this. Meanwhile, your government, if you're in the United States, your government, if you live in the UK, is actively murdering families right now all around the world, is actively bombing, starving, attacking, sanctioning all kinds of people. But no one cares about that. But let's focus on one person's story, because Assad bad guy, because that's the only thing we care about. It's sort of how only COVID-19 at all costs, right? Who cares about cancer and diabetes and suicide? Who cares about any of it? Because COVID is the same thing here. It's only about what they want you to be focusing on. But Thomas follows up and absolutely straight up calls her out for no reason, by the way, seeing as how there's, and you love her, you know, 6 shares, 2 comments, nothing happening here, but just outright goes out of his way to call out Vanessa Beely. Does that show you something? It shows you that she is on his attention, or she has his attention. He's paying attention to what she's saying, which means something. It says, Vanessa, could you use your close relationship and influence with the Syrian regime to encourage the sharing of information about the more than 128,000 Syrians arbitrarily detained, including the brutal place of those who, right? So first of all, the concept of these detentions that I'm not really going to get into in this discussion today, what I've talked about before, are at the very least questionable in regard to who's involved and what's actually happening, as well as the fact that these people are not necessarily what they're being made out to be, right? If somebody tries to assassinate somebody in the presidential, let's say the president, and they get arrested, the U.S. will call that an illegal detention. Doesn't mean that there aren't actually people that are being illegally detained. I'm not arguing that these governments are not capable of that. My point is the U.S. government has knowingly and continually and excessively lied about the Syrian government, as we already pointed out in the show. So Carla Del Ponte points this out, that we lied. The Duma event, or all these we've already discussed, are Mattis admitting we didn't have the evidence, but sure, let's trust them about everything else. My point is that he's making a big deal about this, despite it coming from... Look, let's again, to make the argument fair, let's just take it at face. Let's just say there's 128,000 people that are detained and they shouldn't be. Are we going to pretend like the U.S. government is not doing that right now all around the world? We just discussed the UAE torture prisons that the CIA is operating in Yemen, where the fact that they're literally illegally occupying Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Bolivia, on and on and on, and all the millions of people that live there. We don't care about any of that. All we care about is what we can argue to make the case of Syria bad guy, Assad bad guy. But here's how Vanessa follows up. Could you use your influence with the UK regime to ask white helmets their whereabouts of bodies used to stage the Duma chemical weapon hospital scenes, and who murdered the Syrian civilians to produce propaganda that enabled the UK unlawful aggression against Syria? Oh, no comment, Tom? I wonder why. And take note of how much more she got in response than this MI6 manipulator. But nonetheless, it all comes down to what they want you to think about the story. As I showed you the clip the other day, or the image the other day of what we're saying is democracy. Meanwhile, we have barbed wire fences and people in, you know, full military gear surrounding your capital. And then you look at what they're telling you is a dictatorship. And here's Assad in the middle of a crowd of millions, hundreds of people all, you know, it's you are being lied to. Just like with COVID-19, just like with everything else that's happening here, your government is misrepresenting who they are, what they do, and what they're fighting for. And if you can't see that by now, keep watching this show. We'll keep doing our best to keep you aware of what's really going on. But we'll leave it there, and hopefully we'll get Vanessa back on. Oh, wait a minute. It looks like she is here. Maybe I missed her this whole time. Did I lose you and you came back on? Was I talking that whole time and you were here?
It's okay. My internet dropped off. Don't worry. You did a great job.
good. I was just assuming that you lost your electricity like we talked about.
I'm not far off doing that, but it was actually the internet that dropped out.
Ah, well,
but no, good job. Perfect job.
Thank you. If you got a few more minutes, just give me your comments on what I was saying and what that is, and we can wrap it up right there, because it is some pretty alarming stuff that this guy is threatening you based on that. But please give me your comments.
Well, you know, look, how I tend to see this, as I said before we went live, is at I see it as an opportunity to raise the profile of the work we're all doing. You know, it's an opportunity, and that's how I intend to see it. I'm certainly not intimidated by it. Right. I'm, to some degree, gratified, because it means actually that, you know, relatively obscure commentators, analysts, journalists like ourselves that don't have the massive resources of organizations like the BBC, CNN, etc., are doing enough of a good job that they are having to intimidate us and produce 15 episode series of basically an attack against all those who are challenging, in the case of the BBC, the UK Foreign Office narrative on Syria, right? Mm-hmm. And as I said, I don't remember a time, I could be wrong, but I don't remember a time where government intelligence agencies and foreign office, such as the UK Foreign Office, is being exposed to such an extent.
Yeah.
Right? Globally. I agree. All their operations are kind of out there for everyone to see now. I mean, it's, none of this is clandestine anymore. Everyone's kind of perfectly aware that it's going on if they're reading independent media, of course.
This is kind of why I have this thought. And, you'll remember this. I've been saying this for a very long time, whether it was wishful thinking to begin or not. I'm beginning to continuing to think that there is a misrepresentation of what the majority actually thinks today, right? That where do we get our impression of what the majority is? The only way that's even possible is through the mainstream media today. We're not really capable of skimming the internet and coming away with a real input, because we have our echo chambers and what we look at, right? So the media continues to tell us what the majority is, that if we think this, we're fringe, we're conspiracy theorists. I don't think that's the case. At the very least, I think that a huge possible majority does at least question this right now. And they just misrepresent that and point to the most vocal, uninformed, small minority and say, that's the majority, and let them scream about it. It's still a lot of people though. So in the same sense of whether COVID or foreign policy, that stuff like this is, to your point, is happening because this feels like an end game right now. The way they're driving all this stuff in with COVID, they're, like you're saying, they're exposing their hand. So it, as much as it can feel overwhelming and insurmountable, I think what we need to realize is what Vanessa is saying here is that we are making a difference, and that is why they're pushing back to such a degree. And that's a positive thing. Like, we need to keep doing what we're doing and standing up. Go ahead.
We are destabilizing them.
Yes.
You've suffered a huge amount of censorship. We all have, and we all know that there's more coming.
Yep.
But there wouldn't be censorship if we were not doing a good job. There wouldn't be intimidation if we were not threatening their narrative.
Exactly.
And so as tiresome as it is to deal with sometimes, we have to see it to some degree as a positive. And that's how I tend to see it. Well, okay, it gives us an opportunity to reach more people with the information and the facts and the analysis that we are producing, And then it's up to people. They can make up their own mind. I'm not going to play the same role as the BBC. I'm not going to say, no, you have to listen to my narrative. No. Right. But you can at least have an alternative narrative to the one that is being literally force-fed to you, and that's the same tactic with COVID.
Right.
You are being told you can only listen to a very narrow prism of experts, right?
Right. Well, or just
you're not allowed to look outside that at all.
You're simply not even an expert if you don't have that opinion. So it's not even about being an expert.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And it's the same on Syria. If you don't listen to the UN, if you don't listen to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, then you're going outside the box. And how dare you?
Right.
How dare you challenge our narratives? How dare you challenge our humanitarian pretext for another war against another sovereign nation and another round of sanctions and devastation of infrastructure and collective punishment of a people that are refusing to accept our neo-colonialist projects? Right. I mean, that's the bottom line, right?
Statement right there.
It is
definitely what you can see. That is the most obvious thing right now to take away from whether, because right now people are confused. I get that. Some people, it's really difficult. It's engineered apathy because you don't know where to look, right? Who do I trust? What do I look at? Who's telling the truth? So one thing I always leave with on all of my daily wrap up articles anyway, is I simply say, and I'll just read it as I typed it here. And this is a takeaway for it. Just as it says, take the information that we're talking about in the show today, research it for yourself, come to your own conclusions. Anybody telling you that this is what the truth is or claiming that they have the answer is likely leading you astray for one reason or another, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an easy way to kind of stand back. It doesn't mean they're lying, but recognize that people out there that only are saying this is what you should think and that's it, that should be an immediate red flag to be like, okay, wait a minute. Like, this isn't objective. This isn't research. Yeah. This is narrative, And so that's a good way to go forward on this. It's just, we need to be very careful about who we listen to. And, as I say with us, we don't trust what we're saying. Research it, look into it. That's just the most important thing. And that's what they're afraid of. That's why they're censoring people just like us.
Yeah. I think the important thing to point out, we take the facts and we analyze them. People are perfectly free to go and look at the facts that we're presenting and analyze them with their own perspective. You know, that's what we're doing, but at least have all the facts.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we've gotten to the age of where, you know, human beings are debunked, which what does that even mean? Oh, that guy, he was debunked. And it's like, what? You mean his 30-year career, everything he's ever said was all false? Like, you know, it's like, it's just hyperbolic world that's become. But to end here, this is exactly the point. Is they're afraid of the fact that we are being objective and willing to research. And that's what we're asking you to do out there. Look into it, think for yourself, question the narrative. Thank you for being here. As always, I love speaking with you, Vanessa. And sorry I cut you out there.
Sorry, it was all a bit chaotic tonight. With the cat and the cutouts. And
right. But I'll have you back on as always. I always love having you on.
Bless you. Thank you.
Anything else you want to say before we drop off today?
No, just thanks for having me on and thanks for putting up with all the kind of like distractions tonight.
Always a pleasure. Well, as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.